Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Chief Justice John Roberts arrived in the last hour at the Capitol for the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump.
Senators, I attend the Senate in conformity with your notice for the purpose of joining with you for the trial of the President of the United States.
The Chief Justice took his own oath and then swore in the Senate.
Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God?
It is a moment in the presidency that has happened only twice before in American history. And local constitutional scholar Noah Feldman was part of it. He's a law professor at Harvard. He testified before the House Judiciary Committee hearing in December, and he's on the line with us now. Noah Feldman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
My pleasure.
So, Noah, I want to correct. You testified during the impeachment hearings at the end of last year.
Mm-hmm.
Let's ask, with such a unique perspective on how this process has unfolded, with the impeachment trial formally starting in the Senate today, how do you feel?
I take very seriously the gravity of these events. I think it's always important to remember that even though, you know, we who listen to the radio and read the newspapers and watch television think we know how this trial will probably end, that doesn't mean that the trial isn't serious, isn't important, and that going through the process doesn't have a very crucial role to play in preserving our Constitution. And so I think, you know, the perspective that I have, having been in the middle of that, is to realize that each bit of it matters.
So you actually were one of just a handful of people who will have participated in this moment in history, sort of relatively speaking to all the people in the country. Take us back to your testimony. When did you know you would testify, and how did that feel?
Well, I suppose I didn't know for sure that I would testify till the day it actually happened. You know, I had some brief conversations with staff from the Senate Judiciary, rather from the House Judiciary Committee, who were organizing the hearing. But, you know, they could always have changed their minds, and they could have had a different lineup. So it wasn't until really the moment when I walked into the room that I thought to myself, okay, well, now this is definitively going to
happen.
So
you were sort of on call until the last minute, basically.
Exactly, exactly. They weren't sure who all the participants would be until really the end. We didn't know who the other participants would be, and they could have added or subtracted. All that was within the discretion of the staff of the House Judiciary Committee.
So how much do you know about the role that you or other constitutional scholars might play or could play in what comes next in the Senate?
Well, at present, the only people who aren't senators who are going to be participating in the trial in the Senate are the seven House managers who officially walked over to the Senate today, and those lawyers whom President Trump chooses to defend him. That could change midway through the trial, but until then, all the Senate has determined thus far is that in the first instance, there will be questions. There will be opening statements by both sides. There will be questions submitted in writing by the senators to both sides. And that's all we have so far.
And
there
they
may
haven't
be no
reached,
witnesses called.
They
yeah,
haven't
exactly.
reached out to you for guidance or advice. You haven't heard from impeachment managers who might want constitutional perspective, et cetera.
I haven't been speaking to them in any direct way at all. Traditionally, the House Judiciary Committee staff advises the managers. And I've, of course, been in touch with members of that staff. But I think their job is really pretty clear at this point. You know, their job is to go in front of the Senate and make the case that is already contained in the articles of impeachment. And in doing so, they will draw on the factual evidence that was presented by the very brave witnesses who appeared in some cases, in many cases, directly against the wishes of the president to testify. And they'll also draw, I think, in terms of their legal conclusions, on some of the testimony by the law professors who spoke alongside me.
So let's stay on that for a minute, because a nonpartisan federal watchdog, the Government Accountability Office, reported today that it found that blocking the military aid to Ukraine violated the law. And earlier this week, we learned about these communications between Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who's been serving as the president's personal lawyer, and his associates. Looks like they were working to oust U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, or at least have her under surveillance. It's a little unclear at this point. But it kind of raises this big question, whether new evidence should be admitted to the trial, not whether it's going to be, but whether it should be. What do you think the Constitution would say?
Well, the Constitution gives the sole power to try impeachments to the Senate in the same way that it gives the sole power to impeach to the House of Representatives. In the House, the House members who made the determination to impeach when they did were doing that on the ground that they had enough evidence to convince them that impeachment was appropriate. They could have kept on going. They could have continued to gather even more evidence. But they made a judgment that they had enough evidence to go forward. And in my view, that was probably the right judgment for them to have made at the time, because
Why?
Evidence may keep on coming in indefinitely. And because continuing this process for too long might well have led it, you know, all the way into the summer and then potentially even into the election season itself. And the whole point of an impeachment process is to supervise and sanction a president who is trying to break the system in order to get reelected, as the House concluded Donald Trump had done.
Well, that's not the only way you might impeach a president, but I think you're saying that's the point of this impeachment.
It is, and it's certainly one of the things that the framers had specifically in mind. They talked about it when they were discussing why it wasn't enough just to have re-election as a sanction for a president, but actually to have impeachment. They said, you know, listen, a scenario where a president tries to distort the system of democracy in order to get re-elected is one where we really need impeachment. And the House judged that that's exactly what Donald Trump had done, that the investigations he was seeking were designed to help him unfairly win in the 2020 presidential election. So if that was the charge, as indeed it was, and if the House believed that, as indeed it did, it wouldn't have made sense to wait until the election for the impeachment to happen, because then you wouldn't have been actually blocking the president from taking those steps. So I think it made sense for them to impeach when they did. If there's more evidence that would be useful, of course, logically speaking, the Senate should be prepared to look at it. We understand that in practice, it may be that there aren't 51 votes to get more evidence introduced. But in principle, it seems pretty obvious that if there's more evidence that could shed light on the events, that there should be witnesses to testify.
So if I'm understanding you, I think what you're saying is maybe in principle they should, but they don't have to, and they get to write the rules themselves and do it the way that they want to do it.
That's exactly right. That's what it means that they have the sole power to try impeachments. That means that 51 senators can decide to run this trial pretty much however they choose, and that includes the question of whether they're going to admit witnesses and thereby admit new evidence. Incidentally, they could, you know, just take notice of the evidence that's out there. They don't have to necessarily allow witnesses in. There aren't strict rules in this kind of a Senate hearing like there would be in a criminal trial where the jurors could only take into account information that was presented directly to them. Here, the senators can be aware of other evidence and other information. And they could look to that if they so chose.
All right. So let's talk about the Chief Justice for a minute. The Constitution requires that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court preside over the trial. We spoke with David Gergen yesterday. He has advised four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, two of whom were engaged in impeachment processes. Here is what he said about the Chief Justice, John Roberts.
I think the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presiding over these proceedings in robes, John Roberts, a lot of pressure on him. But I think he will come to represent the symbol of the Constitution itself.
That is a lot of pressure on the Chief Justice. Can he do that? Can he essentially embody the Constitution with his robes and presence in the Senate trial?
Well, first of all, I would say Chief Justice Roberts, who's Chief Justice of the United States, not just Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but Chief Justice of the United States, he's up to the job. He is a fantastic lawyer, and he's someone who spent a lot of his career trying to send a message to the world that the Supreme Court, though it might be ideological, shouldn't be understood as partisan. Now, he might be right or wrong about that, but he's committed to that, and I think he's more than capable of standing up for those principles. But I would just like to add a slightly different perspective there. I mean, I love David Gergen, and I consider him a friend. But my slight difference of opinion with him here is that the senators are also part of the Constitution. They themselves are fulfilling their constitutional duty. They swore an oath to do impartial justice under the Constitution. So if looking at John Roberts reminds him of that, then so much the better. But the Constitution doesn't live in the Supreme Court. That's just one place where the Constitution is operative. It also lives in the House and in the Senate. And so, this impeachment is a constitutional process. We really have to keep that in mind.
It raises an interesting question, because the context in which David was saying it yesterday had to do with what appears to be hyperpartisanship in this process from beginning to end. And so if we have, for example, a Senate trial with rules that have been solely determined and supported by the majority, how does that uphold? Obviously, by the letter of the Constitution, it upholds the Constitution, and yet there is a question of legitimacy that can't be escaped. So how do you think about that question?
Well, I think you're right that there is a question of constitutional legitimacy, but it's really important that we remember that the senators are obligated. They have sworn not one but two oaths to support and defend the Constitution in general when they became senators, and again in the concrete before this trial. So if there's a constitutional violation or a failure of fairness, that's on them. That's their responsibility and it's their fault. I think, you know, it's just really important to keep in mind that our Constitution can't survive in the long run, and our republic can't survive if we just think that it's fine for the president or for Congress or for the Senate to break the rules, because the Supreme Court will come in and save us in the end. The Supreme Court can't save us all the time. And in this instance, the Supreme Court isn't there. Only the Chief Justice is there. All he's doing is presiding, and any ruling that he makes can be overturned by 51 senators. So, you know, in the end, the Constitution lives in us, and our elected representatives have to fulfill the Constitution. And if there's a crisis of legitimacy, it's a crisis that falls back onto us and onto the Republic itself. The Supreme Court, the men in black, and the women in black cannot solve that problem for us.
So let me ask you then, do you have faith that throughout this process, in the participation by our elected representatives and the way the American people hold them accountable, that the core tenets of the Constitution will be at the heart of these proceedings?
I would say that I have hope. When I see the seriousness of the ritual with which this impeachment process is now commencing, I hope that that seriousness of purpose will carry through to the reality of how the trial is conducted. You know, the senators submit questions only in writing, in part by their own choice, so that they won't grandstand, so that they will not push partisanship for the television cameras. That's good. That's a step in the right direction. That pushes the seriousness or purpose of this engagement. Ultimately, when the senators decide how they're going to vote, that is going to be between them and their own conscience. And it's essentially impossible for us to, you know, look inside the soul of another person and know why they're casting the votes that they're casting. So when it comes to that, you know, all we really can do is hope. But I have great hope that the process that we're about to witness will be taken seriously by all participants and will be, you know, faithful to the values of the Constitution.
That's Noah Feldman. He's a law professor at Harvard University who specializes in constitutional studies, and he's one of four legal scholars who testified before the House Judiciary Committee in December. Thanks for being with us. Will you come back again and talk with us more about this?
Gladly.
Okay, so over the last day or so, we have been grappling amongst ourselves here at Radio Boston with what to make of this kerfuffle between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. We figured if we are trying so hard to make sense of it, maybe you are too. So we want to invite you into a conversation to grapple along with us. Just briefly, here is a rundown of what's happened. It all started with reports over the weekend from Politico about a script distributed to volunteers for the Sanders campaign, which was critical of Warren for essentially appealing mostly to elite voters. Here's Elizabeth Warren.
I was disappointed to hear that Bernie is sending his volunteers out to trash me. Bernie knows me and has known me for a long time.
And here's Bernie Sanders.
I got to tell you, I think this is a little bit of a media blow-up that kind of wants conflict. Elizabeth Warren is a very good friend of mine. You have heard me give many speeches. Have I ever said one negative word about Elizabeth Warren?
So then on Monday, anonymous sources spoke to CNN about a December 2018 meeting between the two senators. And in that meeting, the anonymous source says, Warren says Sanders told her that he didn't think a woman could win the presidency. Sanders denies saying it. So then at Tuesday night's debate on CNN, moderator Abby Phillips spins the Sanders denial with no direct question to Warren about what was said.
Senator Sanders, I do want to be clear here. You're saying that you never told Senator Warren that a woman could not win the election.
That is correct.
Senator Warren, what did you think when Senator Sanders told you a woman could not win the election?
I disagreed.
Okay, then, in the credits, after the debate, while the screen's still on, viewers could see a testy exchange between the two senators, but couldn't hear it. CNN waited almost a day to release the audio.
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
Let's not do it right now. You want to have that discussion, we'll have that discussion. You called me. You told me. All right, let's not do it now.
I don't want to get in the middle of it. I just want to say hi, Bernie.
Yeah, good.
Okay, what is going on? Is this a real feud? Is this a CNN media-driven controversy? Who benefits from a rift like this? Call us. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Is this one of those conversations you secretly think you shouldn't be having because it's like not a thing and yet you can't help talking about it at the water cooler at work today? Give us a call. Now, we have some other people to join us, too. Joining us now here in Studio 3, first, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Welcome back, Anthony.
Hi, Tiziana.
It is our week this
yes,
week.
Yes, fun to be here.
Also with us is John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst. John, good to see you as well.
Good to be here.
All right. So, Anthony, I'm going to start with you because you had a piece on BUR this morning about perception among some Bernie Sanders supporters that he's not getting a fair shake from the media or the Democratic Party elite. Now there's this rift emerging. CNN does kind of seem to be playing a role in it. What is your take?
Boy, it's a complicated story because there's a media story, which I know we're going to get into. And I think John Carroll and I agree that this in many ways was sort of ginned up by some pretty sloppy reporting that then was strategically dropped by CNN. And we can get into that. You know, and then it's a political story and who does it benefit? And, you know, you asked me the day before, the day of the debate, Tiziana, did I think that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were going to tussle over this during the debate? And I said, no, because it's not going to help them. It's not going to help either one of them to sort of carve up the progressive vote and anger each other's supporters. And so I was surprised when this kind of erupted during the debate. On the other hand, CNN did everything it could do to ensure that this erupted.
Yeah, so, you had said to me you didn't think it was going to be a thing when we talked about the debate, and it kind of looked like they made sure it was going to be a thing.
Well, the CNN, I mean, we just heard the question there saying, you know, Bernie Sanders denies it, and this ultimately is a he said, she said story. Sanders denies it. Warren says he said it. And then the CNN moderator turns to Sanders and says, Senator Warren, what did you think when Sanders said that after he just said that he didn't say it? So, I mean, are they playing favorites? I'm scratching my head wondering why are they playing it like this?
So, John, what do you think? Why are they playing it like this?
Well, because it's wrestling, you know, basically it's a food fight. That's what they want on TV. It's good for TV ratings. So, I mean, it's funny that Elizabeth Warren goes up and says, you know, you called me a liar on national TV. And Bernie Sanders says, no, you called me a liar. And
no,
the
you.
Truth is, Abby Phillips, the CNN moderator, called him a liar, basically. So it's one of those things where essentially it probably will not mean that much in the end, but it's good drama, it's good conflict, and you know, basically that's what TV wants. That's not necessarily what the candidates want. But let me just add one thing here. You know, when Warren reacted to the talking points that that the Sanders people had, you know, she went from zero to umbrage in about 3.2 seconds, you know, trashing her. The talking points were not trashing her. They were saying basically she's got a limited base. It's mostly affluent and she's not going to open up the party the way Bernie Sanders does. So that's not trashing. And so, you know, everybody, I think, here is sort of discrediting themselves in the way that they're dealing with this.
All right. I was going to respond to that. But within the first 2 minutes, our lines were entirely full. So clearly, Radio Boston listeners have thoughts on this. So let's grab a couple of calls, actually. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We want to hear from you. So Patricia Rockland, how about you? What do you want to say with our panelists?
Well, I don't love how Warren handled herself in this whole situation, but I really do think CNN was the real, you know, to quote, villain here. And I hope that progressives can get past this because, you know, prolonging this Bernie-Warren feud, which I think is largely a media fabrication, will only get us a brokered convention where the superdelegates will put Biden in as the nominee and we'll get 4 more years of Trump. So I think we need to put this behind us.
All right. Thanks for that, Patricia. Sasha, let's add your voice, too. Sasha's calling from Framingham. What's on your mind?
Well, I agree that we need to put this behind us. But if this was behind the Warren campaign, Bernie supporters like myself, it just makes me feel even stronger in my support for Bernie. I made a donation. I signed up to go door to door. I just think it's a sloppy hit job.
Anthony wants to say something about
that. No, it's just really interesting because when this, the day of the debate, when there was a lot of talk of this sort of pending feud, or the feud was already supposedly beginning to happen because of the talking points, the script that the Sanders campaign had and Warren's reaction to it, Bernie Sanders had a huge day. He raised $1.7 million from more than 100,000 small donors. It's his biggest debate day haul of the 2020 campaign. So as we just heard from the caller, a lot of folks were really kind of energized by this feud. Now, that said, you know, I've talked to some Elizabeth Warren supporters today, and they like the way she went up to Bernie Sanders right at the end of the debate and just went right up to him and sort of called him out and said, you know, you made me look like a liar, and I'm facing you face to face and letting you know. Their view of that, this is going to help her.
This is kind of the nevertheless she persisted spirit
exactly,
of Elizabeth
that kind
Warren.
Of thing. Yeah.
Let's take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pull up a chair at the table. Let us know what you think. Jim's calling from Dorchester. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi. Yeah, I guess I'm just echoing a lot of the previous callers at this point. I'm a Bernie guy. I was in 2016. I am now. I like Warren. She's my senator. My wife is a Warren person. And my takeaway from this is everybody needs to let it go. It doesn't help anyone except for the other candidates that aren't Bernie and Warren. I still donate to both of them, and I just want this to go away. It's silly.
So, John, you chuckled.
Yeah, well, I think that a lot of people want it to go away, including probably Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, because they're both getting hurt by this in some ways. They're both getting helped a little bit. They're both getting hurt a little bit. It's a classic Rorschach test. You know, how you hold it up to the light is going to determine how you view it. So you look around at the media response. You know, Virginia Heffernan in the L.A. Times says, you know, this was a masterclass in how to defeat male sexism. Joan Vernachie in the Boston Globe says, big mistake not to shake his hand, because basically you're going to need each other. One of you is going to need the other before this is all over.
Right. And this is why there are progressive groups across the country now are sort of calling for a peace treaty essentially between them, because dividing up the progressive vote in this way, potentially what this could do, like John said, is only going to hurt both of them.
Yeah. So, Anthony, here is Donald Trump, who weighed in about this during a rally in Milwaukee.
According to her, Bernie said, and I don't believe that he said this because, you know, I don't know him. I don't particularly like him. He's a nasty guy. But I don't believe he said it. It's not his deal. You know, you have to know what people say. She said, right, that Bernie stated strongly that a woman can't win for president. A woman can win for president. Fortunately, he didn't.
He seems to be loving it. So does this kind of divide during a primary help the incumbent?
Well, I mean, Sanders even sort of brought this up. I can't remember when, but earlier this week, sort of talking about how this kind of thing, you know, is going to help President Trump, or is, you know, something that journalists want to gin up. And I think what we just heard from President Trump is evidence of that. This is terrific. This takes the discussion off of impeachment. It takes the discussion off of making the case against Donald Trump. And instead, we're participating in this whole story about this little feud between the two candidates on the progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
And it takes the talk away from, or the focus off of, what Bernie Sanders actually said that they both agree on, which is that Donald Trump is a misogynist, racist candidate who is going to weaponize everything he can, and especially against a woman. So there's that part of it that that works to Trump's advantage, is it deflects from that. But one thing, you know, about Warren is she's trying to frame this in a way that makes her the victim. And I think that that is problematic for her in many circles, because she's basically saying, I'm being unfairly taken advantage of here, or I'm being unfairly victimized here. And I think that doesn't help her in terms of her credibility. I think she's had problems with or issues with likability, electability, and credibility most recently. And this plays into that to some degree.
It's so complicated here, because I hear the credibility argument. And also, I apologize, I don't remember which one of you said, I think it was you, John, said, this is a classic he said, she said. And we do know that historically, women lose in a he said, she said moment. It's the woman's credibility that's called into question. It's actually part of the reason I think it would have been helpful for everyone if she had simply been asked the question, what did he say to you?
Right.
Anthony.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting because, again, going back to the CNN original story by CNN, and I thought Matt Taibbi did a great job tearing it apart in Rolling Stone yesterday. I mean, the account of the meeting was based on two people that Warren spoke with directly soon after the encounter and two people familiar with the meeting. In other words, it's based on one recollection, Warren's recollection, and two people she talked to. The number of actual sources in the room, one, Elizabeth Warren. So in a way, I thought CNN did it gave a lot more credence to Warren's claim. I mean, this wasn't a revelation. This wasn't a fact revealed. This remains a he said, she said story. So again, to me, it just comes down to incredibly shoddy journalism on CNN's part for the purposes of ginning up a fight, you know, just a couple of weeks before the Iowa caucuses when they should have been talking about policy.
Okay, John, make a quick comment, then I'm going to go to Ernie.
Yeah, let's leave open the possibility that they're both telling the truth, that, you know, what he said was not what she heard. And it may be that they're both telling the truth. And it's true what Anthony says. You know, this is the media ginning something up because it's drama and conflict.
And let me just add that I am surprised at both of them that one of them just didn't come up with the line, look, perhaps we just recollect this conversation differently, right? Okay, you remember it one way, I remember it another way, let's move on. And initially, I think they did try to move on, but CNN sort of dragged them back into it.
Let's grab a couple more calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ernie is calling from Beacon Hill. Ernie, pull up a chair.
Hi, folks. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for taking the call. So my thought all along, this is clearly a calculated move by the Warren campaign. And I, you know, however you believe what was said or not said in that room, she continued that on into the debate. And I think it's very simple. For whatever reason, she's looking for, you know, separation in Iowa from Bernie and decided to play this issue. So I don't think it's an accident. I don't think it's a slip of the tongue. I don't think news like that comes out from a source. As you said, there's one person in the room who's generating that information. And so it's a political calculation.
Well, you know, I don't entirely disagree with the caller because, you know, at first during the debate, Warren made an effort to de-escalate and she calls Bernie her friend and says she wants to move on. But it's also clear that she came to that debate ready. I mean, that was a terrific line that she delivered, one of the most memorable lines of the debate when she pointed out that the men on the stage had lost a collective 10 elections while the two women on the stage hadn't lost any. I mean, she was ready for it. And clearly walking up to Bernie Sanders at the end the way she did, that had to have been thought about beforehand as well. So, yeah, but who's to say? I don't know if it was premeditated, but
let's grab
she was ready
call.
For it.
Kelsey in East Boston, go ahead.
Hi, I think that it's really unfair that people are talking about Elizabeth Warren as a victim as a bad thing. She's a victim. She's a victim of very archaic ideas. And I think that if we continue to say things like it's difficult for a woman to be elected as president, if we continue to remind ourselves of these very old thoughts that we have, it's just going to make it even harder. And I think that things like that shouldn't be said, even if they were deliberating cordially, they just shouldn't be said, and we should just move on from that era in our history.
So, Kelsey, both John and Anthony had thoughts on that. John?
Yeah, well, this is a classic problem because there is an issue about women and their viability in terms of higher office. And you have a whole lot of surveys that say, you know, I'd vote for a woman. I'm comfortable voting for a woman for president, but the guy who lives next door to me isn't. And so it becomes, as Yvonne Abraham said in the Globe today, sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
You don't vote for the woman because you think no one else is going to vote for the woman.
Exactly.
Even though you think the woman's qualified.
They're playing pundit. And a lot of the choices, and this even goes with Joe Biden, too, a lot of the choices is, you know, who do I think everybody else is going to vote for? And that's the electable person, and that's who I'm going to vote for, despite the fact that I believe that this person would be a better president.
Yeah, and there's solid polling on this. I mean, I was looking at a poll by Ipsos for the Daily Beast. It found that 74% of independents and Democrats say they were comfortable with a woman president, but only 33% thought the same of their neighbors. And, you know, I've actually found this. Yeah, I found this anecdotally. I was out in Iowa at a Warren event a couple of months ago, and I talked to a woman, a couple of women who were like all in for her. Are you going to support her? Well, I don't know, because I'm not so sure a woman can win. So they were thinking of their neighbors. They wanted to support her, but they were thinking that probably their neighbors weren't ready to support her. So it's a real thing. As much as we'd like to believe that this is an antique notion and it's time to move on from, unfortunately, it's a real thing in America.
Okay, lots of calls in queue. So let's add Jesse to the discussion. Jesse from Lexington, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I am a Warren supporter. I took her class in law school in bankruptcy, and she earned my trust. This whole week has actually caused me to sign up to host more phone banks and go volunteer more shifts.
How come, Jesse?
Because what I see is I have friends who support Bernie or other candidates, but there's a very large contingent of people who say they support Bernie, especially online, who when you have a civilized, positive conversation about who you like and why, they say really crude, crass things back that are very explicitly about disliking women and distrusting women. So I think the narrative today from some of the other callers isn't really the narrative. Bernie had an opportunity to stand up there and say, if you support me, you support women. My supporters need to lay back on attacking women online. I feel attacked by some people online who, when I just say I like Warren, get out there, vote for who you want, they literally talk about body parts back. And that
doesn't make
me feel good about Bernie's leadership. He needs to set a higher tone. Warren is really...
So actually, Jesse, I'm going to take it back from you there. Really important perspective to bring into the conversation, John.
Yeah, this is the Bernie bro factor, and it's going to hurt him in the end. And let's keep in mind how the Iowa caucuses work. You know, if you don't get 15% the first time around, you know, you don't get any delegates at all. So if Elizabeth Warren gets 14%, then are her people going to go to a second choice, and is it going to be Bernie Sanders? And this whole idea of uniting the progressives is something that is going to be more difficult now because of this. And it's been pretty vicious on Twitter. There's a lot of people tweeting snakes at Warren.
Right.
Snake
hashtag
emojis.
Lying Liz and snakes and hashtag never Warren.
Which
and all
does
this
not
things.
Bode yeah. well for whoever
and it does
comes
feel
in
like
second
it
in the caucuses.
It underscores that underlying gender dimension to this whole thing that is hard to get a handle on, but that you know is there.
Now, let me read, though, a tweet from Jane O'Meara Sanders. This is Bernie Sanders' wife. She tweeted out, it's about the Sanders campaign is about unifying people across our country, not dividing them up by race, ethnicity, or gender. Forget those who are trying to divide us. Focus on building the progressive movement and be positive to succeed.
All right. So, Anthony and John, I want to ask you both one last question. We've got a little bit more than a minute left. One part of this was a media critique. Should the media be covering this campaign differently than it is, John?
Should? Yeah. Would? No. They're never going to cover it any differently. It's all a horse race. It's all drama. It's all conflict. That's what they want. And, you know, one of the things that's going to be crucial here is what happens if Bernie Sanders doesn't get the nomination. He wasn't very enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton's nomination and didn't do a whole lot to support her. Neither did his people. That could come back to bite the Democrats as well.
And Anthony, last word?
Yeah, I mean, I just think the media and, you know, we're part of the media.
Yes, we are.
We've got to stay away from that stuff. And I think we have to call it out when mistakes are made. And I think CNN did not acquit itself very well in this instance. And I'm glad we spent part of this segment talking about that.
All right. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Another iconic Boston restaurant's closing. Top of the Hub in the Prudential Center will shutter permanently along with the Prue's Skywalk Observatory in April. The people behind the restaurant say business has been strong, but the owners of the space, Boston Properties, just decided not to renew their lease. Top of the Hub's closure follows that of other historic eateries, including Durgan Park, No Name Restaurant, Doyle's Cafe, Anthony's Pier 4. So how is the restaurant scene in Boston changing, and what does it mean to lose a place like Top of the Hub? We want to hear from you. Give us a call and share your thoughts. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Meanwhile, here in Studio 3 to help us talk about it is Irene Lee, co-owner and head chef of the May May Restaurant Group. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
We also have on the line Mary White. She's an anthropology professor who thinks about food at Boston University. Mary, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So let me start with you, Irene. What was your initial reaction when you heard that Top of the Hub was closing?
I think my initial reaction was that I'm not sure that I've ever been there. And so I had to call my mom and say, hey, when I was little, did we ever actually go to Top of the Hub? And the answer is yes. But the truth is I have not been there in over two decades.
And it sounds like you don't remember going there.
Exactly. So either. I think that, you know, that might be the case for a lot of Bostonians, although there have been many who have said that this is a very sad time and they remember their special occasions there.
Mary, you chuckled as soon as you heard Irene say, my first reaction is I don't think I've ever been there.
Yes, I chuckled because I do think it's generational. And I think at the Top of the Hub became iconic for people who've been around a longer time. And maybe I haven't been there for 20 years, but I certainly was there as a younger person. And it did become a place where you went for a birthday or an anniversary or to propose to someone, you went for the view. I think the reason it's an icon is much more about the view than the food. And, it could be about the drink. It was a place to have a celebratory toast. I remember once about, gosh, can I say this, 40 years ago.
You certainly can say it.
I've said it. About 40 years ago, some friends and I decided we'd do a progressive dinner at Boston restaurants. So in those days, that meant a course here, a course there, and the restaurants didn't like it very much, but it was a trend. So we thought we'd start at Top of the Hub because then we'd get this overview of the whole city, 360 degrees, and we'd be able to sort of spot where we're going to have the first course, second course, dessert. We're going to move around that view. We got up there, about a dozen of us, and it was fogged in. There was no view at all. But we still drank a lot and had a wonderful time because it was there.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What's your story of the special occasion going up to the Top of the Hub? Or was the Top of the Hub, as a fairly high-priced fine dining place, someplace that was never accessible to you, and therefore the view of Top of the Hub wasn't accessible to you either? We've got Stephen on the line from Wakefield. You're going to share a memory, aren't you, Stephen?
Yes.
Please do.
Yeah, so I actually proposed to my wife at Top of the Hub back in 2015, and I'm really bummed that it's closing. I actually had the proposal written out on a plate of cookies that the waiter brought out, and I really cherished that moment.
I'm sorry it's going away for you, Stephen, but I'm glad that she said yes, because you did say she's your wife now.
Yes, definitely.
So, Irene, so we've established that maybe it's someplace people don't regularly go. But that it is a kind of a destination place. What does it mean to lose an icon like that, even if it's an icon that people like to know is out there but didn't actually go to?
Well, I think it means something different for all the Bostonians. Of course, I think it was frequented also by tourists. So that means that tourists might have to find some other way either to get up to the Prue. Boston Properties, the landlord, says they're going to open something new and exciting. So they're keeping the view, just replacing maybe whatever the attraction is. But I don't know. I think for me and in my circles and the folks I'm listening to, Top of the Hub just wasn't particularly relevant to us.
So
and
it really, I think that, you know, as Mary says, a generational thing.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, we are coming to equate luxury with specialness a little bit less now. And so I think that a lot of diners are looking for experiences that are more personal, feel more intimate, where they have a connection with the restaurant or the chef. And I personally don't have a deep connection with seafood towers. But I think that, you know, when we think about a special occasion, I think that's changing.
So, Mary, what does the closure mean for the fine dining, that traditional white napkin fine dining scene in Boston?
You know, I think that the Top of the Hub, though it was glamorous, was not really ever about the food. I mean, if you look at the menu, it has been pretty consistent. Not that exciting. And so what it means for fine dining to have it disappear, I don't think it has much relevance. I think, you know, it's, you know, just look at the dress code, business casual. That does not feel very exciting. The shellfish platter, the oysters, that's what I would go for, is just the very simple things that say Boston. Boston has a lot of touchstone foods that aren't necessarily, especially what those of us who really care about food would go for. Lobster roll, sure, I'll go for the lobster roll. But I think for fine dining, we're all much more interested in interesting food, and that it wasn't.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kristen's calling from Reading. Go ahead, Kristen.
Hi. So I actually grew up in New Hampshire, and for my senior high school prom, my date and I skipped the prom, and we went to Top of the House.
Was there a view that night?
Yes, it was absolutely gorgeous. It was so magical. It was way better than the prom.
That's great, Kristen. Thanks for the call. Let's take another one. We've got Diana on the line from East Boston. Go ahead, Diana.
Hi. I've been in the industry for a long time. I have worked in many restaurants, and I have friends that work there that have been working there for 20, 30 years. And no one talks about these employees. What's going to happen to them?
How are they feeling today, Diana? What have you been hearing?
They found out yesterday through a meeting that they were going to close. And the news already knew about it. And I don't think it's fair. I think these just restaurants go around and playing with people's lives. And it's just no one talks about the effect on the employees, the effect on the people that have dedicated their whole life to places like this.
That's such an important point, Diana. And we think there are about 200 employees who will lose their jobs. And if we're hearing that this type of cooking and serving is not in vogue anymore, one has to worry and think about how they are going to transition to other roles in the restaurant scene. Thank you for reminding us of that real human cost, Diana. Irene, you're nodding. You were nodding all the way through Diana's call.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that Diana brings up the staff. I think that, you know, some of the other restaurants that have closed recently have provided zero notice. And I think there are a lot of problems with that, obviously. So for me, I look at this and say, well, Top of the Hub gave them a few weeks at the very least. I mean, that's not a very high standard to hold an employer to.
Especially somebody who's worked there 20, 30 years. Maybe.
Absolutely. But hopefully, you know, we always talk about the labor shortage in our industry. And so it would be my hope that all of these great employees can find good homes in other restaurants.
So, Mary, this is one of a number of closings. I went through some of the list at the top. Durgan Park, No Name, Doyle's, Anthony's Pier 4. What is going on? Is this economic? Is it cultural? Is it, I mean, we've already talked about the fact that it's probably partly generational, but what else is going on here, Mary?
Well, I think we are losing something important. And I think I'm not exactly sure why. We don't have a lot of those reliable old school places where you could be a regular, you'd come in and the front of the house people would know you. I think those are the people who are going to regret the loss of this. The kinds of special event places that this represents, I think they're less available. They're much more expensive. You want a place like Frank's Steakhouse in North Cambridge, where, you know, you have this comfortable dark wood, comfortable banquets. You want a place like that, where you know you're going to be welcomed, everybody knows your name sort of place. Those are the ones. Doyle's has disappeared. I think that we're going to find that you're going to have to make your own. I think Irene said this, that it's going to be a very individual, personal process of relocating your home base in food.
Let's grab another call here. We've got Andrea on the line from Cambridge. Go ahead, Andrea.
Yes, hi. So the building was completed in 1964. I was there, and the restaurant opened in exactly the time that the building was completed. It was so exciting. I was 14 years old at the time, and I and a couple of my friends took off school.
Took off in quotes, right, Andrea?
Yeah, and that was always the destination. And finally, my mother and father and brother agreed to take us to go out for dinner on Easter and have a wonderful meal at the Top of the Hub. And, so we knew the views. We had those down. But you couldn't see out. Unless you had a table that was on the edge, you weren't anywhere that mattered and the food was lousy. And I was only 15 years old, and I knew the food was lousy. I'm sorry, but that's how it is.
All right, let's take it from there. You know, let's talk about the – I'm going to stay off the food is lousy part, but I – although I think we have another caller who I'm not going to get to, who I know when he called in wanted to make clear that he thought the food was actually quite good and had enjoyed it. But I want to shift to this view conversation for a minute, because food is a very cultural experience for us. And we also know that we have a gentrifying Boston. One of the things that's interesting in reading the articles about this closing today is that people act, they don't act, but they speak about Top of the Hub as if it were a public space, because you could at least pay money for food or drink and go up there and have a view that otherwise is utterly exclusive in the city of Boston. But that drink is a $6.50 Bud Light. So is food becoming part of the gentrification of our city, Irene? And if so, how do we think about that?
I think that food can be a way to fight gentrification as much as it can be a tool of gentrification. I think when we see what's going on in the Seaport and in other neighborhoods where there's so many chain restaurants, and I think... For me, I hope that gentrification is something that small, independent, mom-and-pop restaurants can keep fighting. That's my hope for our industry.
So, and then, well, Mary, let me ask you if you have anything you want to add to that.
Yeah, I think that gentrification is one of those words that has many meanings depending on who you are, of course. And I think if you find that the so-called gentry, the people who are moving in and supposedly have a little more available cash, are actually doing things that are not always the high-end white tablecloth restaurants. They're going for the $2 tacos at Taco Loco. They're going for neighborhoods that are still in process. And so I think it's not one thing. Yeah, this Seaport district, I mean, it's very hard to imagine that as a neighborhood with, you know, mom and pop shops. But people are moving into all kinds of neighborhoods now and appreciating what is local, what is the, you know, ethnic component of that neighborhood and its food. So I don't think gentrification is just one thing. But yes, I really hope that the chains are not going to dominate, you know, most of Boston now. It's extremely boring. It's like an airport.
So, Irene, what is the next big food trend, do you think, in Boston?
That's such a great question. I think that food that sort of helps people adhere to their dietary preferences or restrictions is, of course, becoming even more popular. For me personally, I love that there are more and more restaurants that I can go to and feel like I am in the chef's home, sitting at their table, really being in conversation with them and getting a sense of what their life experience is, where their family's from, how they grew up eating. And so I think for me, that's the most exciting thing. And certainly Top of the Hub was not a great example of that.
All right.
There's so many now.
Irene Lee, co-owner and head chef of the May May Restaurant Group, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Mary White, anthropology professor at Boston University, thanks to you too.
Thank you. And hi, Irene.
Hi, Mary.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I am Tiziana Deering. I am hungry now, but I do hope you will join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.